Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Thomas Kimmel, registration number 9043. I'm here today to represent Zarlingo & Kimmel, which is a firm of which I'm the sole attorney. And what I'm here today is to appeal an award of attorney's fees that was made against Zarlingo & Kimmel by the Weld County District Court in the approximate amount of $17,000. The issue of when do attorney's fees get assessed against attorneys is well established in Colorado. We have both statutes and case law that set forth very firm rules on that. The rule is that essentially there needs to be a specific finding of substantially frivolous, groundless, or vexatious action on behalf of the attorney, and there needs to be specific findings under the applicable statutes. It's clear in this case that the Weld County District Court did none of the above and utterly failed to follow these rules in awarding attorney's fees against Zarlingo & Kimmel.
I ask you, Mr. Kimmel, does the court need to say the words substantially frivolous or without justification, or is it sufficient if the facts reveal that the court was looking at the correct factors?
I would submit that, yes, the magic word has to be rendered by the court that this action lacks substantial justification or under the terms of the applicable statute, which is 1317.102. The language there is that attorney's fees can be recovered if the action is determined to have been substantially frivolous, substantially groundless, or substantially vexatious. So that is the magic word, and the case law has said the same thing. The case law has said that when you deny attorney's fees, the court doesn't necessarily need to make findings in that regard. But when you grant them, it is required that the court not only make that express finding of substantial lack of substantial justification, but also there's a statute that says here are the factors that the court has to consider and set forth its reasons in order to find that an attorney is responsible for attorney's fees.
What do you do with a case like Anderson, for example, where, as I remember it, the Supreme Court case from last year, that the court can't make conclusory statements that it was lacks substantial justification, as it need only discuss the 103 factors if it's going to award attorney's fees. Let me give you a hypothetical, which I suppose is related to this. Say the only issue, hypothetically, the only issues your opponent raised were this was clearly violated the statute of limitations, and anyone should have known that. And the court says, clearly this violated the statute of limitations. I award attorney's fees. Does the court need to actually say substantial justification when it's clear from the face of the order that the court was saying, you filed something late? Do you really have to use the magic words in that situation?
I think you do, because remember, we attorneys lose cases all the time. And if every time we lost the case, we were subject, and it was a real possibility that we could be awarded attorney's fees, this would turn our profession into a very stressful, unrewarding occupation. We have ethical duties to zealously represent our client, and all attorneys need to do is to have rational arguments that are based in law and in fact that support the claim. And without that, attorney's fees can't be awarded. So back to your scenario. First, a statute of limitations and affirmative defense. And just to follow up on your question, the law is very clear that an affirmative defense can't be the basis to find frivolous and groundless, that someone that files a complaint doesn't have to anticipate that an affirmative defense is going to be raised, that it could be waived, and therefore that's not part of an attorney's obligation.
But if it gets raised, and I'm playing devil's advocate,
yes,
of course,
I'm
sorry the line, if it gets raised, could the court ultimately say, I found it frivolous because I found a reasonable lawyer would have discovered the statute of limitations problem? I guess what I'm asking is, couldn't the court award attorney fees in that situation you know, once, I guess I'm worried, maybe you're saying, as a matter of law, the court can never award attorney's fees for a complaint that was filed beyond the statute of limitations. I'm not sure if you're going that far, but if you are, I'm wondering if that's really right.
You have Court of Appeals decision, 1985, and the Supreme Court in that Brubake case, both say exactly that, that you can never award attorney's fees against someone for filing a complaint simply based on a statute of limitations. That, again, it's an affirmative defense. I'm sorry.
Be failing to respond what Gabriel was raising, and that is, can you imply from the findings the court made that it did consider the factors for an award of attorney fees, even when it doesn't say those, quote, magic words, unquote?
Well, I interpret this court's ruling to be almost like any summary judgment ruling I've ever seen, that the court was evaluating the claims, evaluating the facts. It was essentially a summary judgment ruling. The court has to go beyond a simple analysis of who wins summary judgment or who doesn't in order to award attorney's fees. It has to be an egregious situation. The court needs to find that the attorney acted in bad faith, or that there was no rational argument for the claim that was asserted by the attorney in this complaint.
So what you're really saying here is, although the court made some findings that there was an issue of standing and there was an issue of statute of limitations, that alone doesn't indicate to us that the court found it was without substantial justification. There may have been a reason that you didn't discover that or whatever. Exactly. That's the point you're making. The fact that the court held there was a statute of limitations problem is not alone enough to justify the fees. We need more.
Exactly.
Is that the point?
The mere fact that you don't prevail doesn't make it substantially frivolous and groundless. It could be more than that.
And here you would say, we don't know anything more than the fact you didn't prevail. We can't read into the court's holding that it was making a finding of laxity. Okay, correct.
And further, I'd ask the court that not only, I think, you clearly have to reverse this decision. I mean, the court did not follow your rules when it cut the rules of the statute and the rules of the case law as to imposing liability upon attorneys for attorney's fees of the other side. In addition, you have the same record available to you that the court did, and I submit you should find as a matter of law that I did not engage in frivolous or groundless behavior in this case. The real gist of the case and the linchpin of the court's analysis, the court had a profound misunderstanding, I submit, as to what a reformation claim is. What happened in this case, briefly, is that my client's mother, in 1951, had conveyed the surface of property in Weld County and had preserved 50% of the Merrills. 3 years later, May Dorsey, along with a neighbor, executed a quitclaim deed in favor of defendant's predecessor. That quitclaim deed made no mention of any mineral rights, and I encourage all of you to look at that deed. It went into great lengths about the water rights, that there were water rights, irrigation rights, ditch rights, and Dorothy Peters, the other person that joined in the deed, would have had no reason to join in it if the intent hadn't been to convey water rights only. So our claim was that this deed wasn't properly drafted, and although it said all right title and interest, and therefore it's not ambiguous necessarily in that regard, the intent of the parties in the agreement was that they were simply going to convey water rights. And where the court went wrong, district court, the court said that in order to have a reformation claim, you have to have an ambiguous deed. And that's simply wrong. Because reformation, I've had reformation cases in the past. I had one which involved an incorrect property description. The parties had just described the parcel wrong. The deed was unambiguous, but it didn't reflect the party's intent.
What do you argue? I'm sorry, please, Counselor, do we get to that issue if you're correct that the court has to make express findings of groundless and frivolous? Do we get to the merits of the complaint?
Well, I understand. I mean, I do think that under this record, you're in a position to rather than remanding it back to Weld County District Court to determine on your own that there were rational arguments for this complaint as a matter of law, and therefore it's not groundless and frivolous. If the court doesn't feel they can go that far, then I would request that you remand it back to the district court and require them to go through those findings, and I'll present whatever evidence is appropriate to the court at that time. In terms of the statute of limitations, again, I was not aware of the statute of limitations as being a possible defense when I filed the complaint. When it was raised and other things happened, I had conversations with my client that ultimately led me to withdraw from this case. And what burdens do we want to impose upon attorneys if the client won't follow their recommendation to dismiss a claim or to settle a case after defenses come up? I did everything I could, and I ultimately withdrew from the case, and I was told by the client that they had found another lawyer to represent their interests. So I think if you look at the record, the theories that were asserted in this complaint were rational, there were facts to support them all, and not only did the Weld County District Court fail to follow procedures, but there's also no basis to conclude that this was a groundless and frivolous filing. I know this court addresses this issue all the time as to how bad is it, what egregious conduct is enough to require an attorney to be personally liable for the other side's attorney's fees. And it's an egregious standard. It's not simply you lose the case. So I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimmel. Hinsey or Ms. Hines?
Hines,
I'm sorry.
Hello, everybody.
Well, welcome. I apologize.
May it please the court and Mr. Kimmel. My name is Kristen Hines, and my attorney registration number is 21368, and I represent Koenig Investments LLC, the appellee. Yes, this case is solely about whether the attorney fee sanctions were appropriate against plaintiff's counsel. What has not been appealed is the underlying decision. The actual decision dismissing this case was not appealed either by the plaintiff or by Mr. Kimmel. So the court's findings in this matter stay. They are not on review. So the question that the court should be looking at is, number one, within the findings of the court's order, is there a basis to conclude that there was a lack of substantial justification for the award of fees? The statutes 1317, 102, and 103 were employed so that courts would have a way to address the onslaught of litigation and to address litigation that wasn't warranted. It's a balancing act between unwarranted litigation and zealous representation. I have found no fees award that has been overturned solely because a court did not use the magic words we were talking about. There are cases where those words were used, lack of substantial justification, frivolous, and groundless. But because the court's order didn't further find specific findings that substantiated that conclusion, sure, that's reversible. But what's not reversible is when there are specific findings within the court's order that breed the conclusion that, yes, this case did lack substantial justification. Conclusions like there was an absolute failure to plead either reformation of deed based on mutual mistake or reconstructing a deed due to lack of ambiguity based on the claim that the deed doesn't say what the parties intend.
I guess I don't understand that argument, Ms. Hines. I mean, in any case of mutual mistake, it seems to me the deed will be unambiguous. How does that get you to no reformation claim?
Correct. Those are two separate claims, and I felt that the pleadings in the complaint was a little bit ambiguous. I didn't know whether the plaintiffs were really going for, well, the judge needs to take a look at the deed and find that the parties somehow didn't intend what was on the deed. And there's a doctrine there that you can't write something into a deed. You can't change a deed based on what the parties did not actually intend if the four corners of the deed don't breed an ambiguity.
Sure, but didn't, in this case, Mr. Kimmel's client specifically plead, or Mr. Kimmel, I guess, plead mutual mistake? He basically laid out the facts. It was only the stuff, what he recited today, that it was only intended to be water rights, and they didn't do that, et cetera, et cetera. You make an argument on 9B requires to plead mistake with reasonable particularity. I guess I'm wondering what else he should have said.
Oh, he should have said there was an agreement between the two parties, Paul C. Thompson and May Dorsey, that said X, that said we are intending to transfer only water facilities, not water facilities and the remainder of the fee, which was the mineral estates.
How is the complaint different than that? And I'm not fighting you, I apologize.
Yeah, in the reformation cases, and you're correct, if you've looked at the deed and you found that it's unambiguous, then the next level of inquiry is, okay, it's unambiguous, so is there a reformation based on mutual mistake claim? And that's where the second part of the argument came. And the findings that the pleadings were insufficient, because in reformation cases, especially reformation of a deed, because a deed is a document that is recorded, it establishes title, and third parties rely on that deed in the future. And so the cases state that to prove reformation of a deed based on mutual mistake, you have to show, number one, that there was a very specific agreement between the parties that says X. Number two, that this agreement was still in place at the time the instrument was signed. And number three, that both parties did not catch that there was a mistake in the deed. Those are the three elements. Now, as far as the pleading goes, Rule 9B says that if you plead mistake, that is a special pleading rule, and notice pleading will not suffice. The case that I found on fraud that seemed to be the closest one I could find to relate to this issue was the Fidelity Finance v. Goff. And in that case, what happened with that is they had actually pled that there was a specific change in a promissory note to the date, to the due date of the note and the interest rate. But the court said, you know, that's not specific enough. You have to express with particularity the circumstances surrounding the alleged fraud, in our case, the alleged mistake. You have to give enough notification that there was really specifically, these parties were really specifically headed in a different direction, and there's going to be...
And not to beat the dead horse, as I remember, the complaint, I think, said, the intent of the parties to the deed dated, et cetera, was to simply convey water rights. Right. The parties did not intend to convey 50% mineral interest. To the extent the deed is interpreted to also convey the above mineral interest, it was drafted and executed under mutual mistake. You seem to be asking that he needs to plead all of his evidence, and I'm not... Yeah. That seems like pretty good notice.
If anybody can say, hey, they were intending something else, the courts don't want people to be able to just say, hey, you know, they intended to do this. They could have just as easily intended that they were passing both rights, both the mineral estate and the water facilities. There's no basis for that, and there has to be at least an evidence that there's going to be a basis for that allegation.
Isn't that the issue for trial?
That's a pleading issue. That's what I'm saying. I think that's what the rule requires, is before you get to the court where parties have to spend the time to respond to a pleading, there has to be enough substantiation within the allegations. Let me find it.
So if he had said, instead of just saying there's a mutual mistake, he would have said the parties never agreed to convey it, that would be sufficient?
Rule 9 says you have to plead the circumstances constituting the mistake, and they shall be stated with particularity. And claiming intent certainly doesn't mean there was an agreement, because who knew what the parties intended? An agreement is requires the coming together on the meeting of the minds of the parties. And so just saying, hey, they intended this, doesn't establish that there was actually an express agreement. And so I think that's what I understood from reading the Fidelity Finance case and the State Farm v. Parrish case. You can't just kind of make a blanket claim that, you know, they were headed off in this direction. Okay.
Sainz, let me kind of just bring you back, and I probably got you off track, and I'm sorry, to the issue that really I think is squarely presented here, and that's the question of whether the court's findings were sufficient. I think you would agree with what Mr. Kimmel said, that just because a party loses doesn't mean the claim is frivolous and groundless, correct? You would agree with that.
But I'm sorry, could you
just because a party loses doesn't mean its claim
is
frivolous.
Absolutely. All right. That is not the contention.
Here we have a one-liner from the, well, three lines, two lines in a word. Further, the defendant Koenig is entitled to recover its reasonable cost and attorney's fees jointly and severally. There's no explanation whatsoever. It doesn't say for the reasons set forth above. There's, you know, are we left to guess at why the court awarded fees? I mean, it says paragraph 15 of the court's order granting the motion to dismiss. I get the court made a bunch of findings, as Mr. Kimmel pointed them out, and you know, ruled your way on the merits on all these issues. How do we know that the court, or why, these are substantially, you know, without justification? We have a one-liner from the court. Doesn't the court need to give us more than that?
I think in making the specific findings that the court did, it did so. When a court finds that there hasn't been enough in the pleadings to bring the case forward, it's hard to argue that, well, there really was a rational basis to proceed when the pleadings did not satisfy the ruling.
But wouldn't that, if we took that to its logical extreme, any time a court grants a motion to dismiss, fees need to be awarded?
Not any time a court grants a motion to dismiss.
Well, by definition, a motion to dismiss is granted for failure to state a claim. I should have been more specific.
Yeah.
That the pleadings were insufficient. Your theory would say whenever the court says grants a motion to dismiss because the pleadings were insufficient, fees should be awarded. It's necessarily frivolous and groundless. And I guess I'm not aware of a case that goes that far.
Okay. I would say that in the context of this case, there were a number of rulings that indicated that this case was brought without substantial justification.
And could you focus on that? Tell me which rulings you're talking about and how we would know the court was saying without substantial justification.
Sure. The court has indicated in its findings that it didn't have the facts to support the reformation of mutual mistake. And that's on paragraph 11 I'm looking at in the order. The court did not, again, this goes to the intent question, number 10, that there was absolutely no ambiguity. And so on the basis of trying to have the court interpret the intent of the parties, there was no substantial justification because it wasn't pled. The statute of limitations, this claim was brought, 58 years after the quitclaim deed was signed, and the court found that the relevant statute of limitations bars the claims in this matter. I would like to make a note that this was egregious because Mr. Kimmel was aware that a valid statute of limitations claim had already been raised in the case. He then withdrew. He then reentered the case and refiled the complaint as an amended complaint without amending the pleadings. And so there is a distinction between the case law that he cited in this, and that alone, I think, is substantial grounds for this finding.
The amended complaint was simply a restatement exactly of the original complaint?
Except he did add the parties that were missing. And so the parties that he had failed to name originally were added in. So there's some substantial discussion of these matters in the brief, of course, but I hit on the statute of limitations problem. Another manifest problem with the case. And again, I think the court's look to the record to see whether or not the record supports the finding that there was a lack of substantial justification. And legally, another problem with the complaint was that you can't bring a reformation of deed action if there have been parties later on that rely on that record. They buy their property thinking they have these oil rights, and they find that they do not. And that's called a bona fide purchaser for value. And that completely prohibits a reformation action for the case law.
Is there any evidence presented anywhere? I guess the question is whether we got that far. I understand the law. It seems this Haney or Heaney case arguably supports Mr. Kimmel's argument that the heirs could bring the reformation claim, and I think you may well have had a reasonable or strong defense on a bona fide purchaser for value, but did we even get that far? Was there any evidence put on about that? This was on a motion to dismiss.
Well, it's a legal standard. In a quiet title action, the proponent of the claim has to establish a superior title. They cannot do that as a matter of law if there are deeds of record that show that there are bona fide purchasers for value. I'm simply stating what the legal status of the claim was. Totally a legal argument. So, and finally, I would say that I've covered most of it. You know, we're asking a little bit about the intent of the parties, and another factor that was of the record. And again, a lot of these things that were of the record went against this claim for mutual mistake. And one of the things that went against this claim was the fact that Paul C. Thompson, who received the 50% mineral interest under the quitclaim deed, later received the other 50% interest through the D.T. Thompson chain, and then turned around, and when he conveyed the property in 1961, he reserved 75% of the minerals. So at least on the record, again, this goes to what facts were pled that would even support that there was this agreement by the parties. So
I guess the problem with that is we didn't get to the evidence. I mean, yes, Mr. Thompson filed that. I understand your argument. I mean, hypothetically, they could have put on a witness to say, and Mr. Thompson was a big fat liar, with all due respect. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't get that far. Mm-hmm. And so that's a concern about that.
But they didn't even plead that there was an agreement.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. Mr. Kimmel, I want you to use your time as you would, but I would appreciate your addressing this issue about your kind of re-entering an appearance on the amended complaint that was a little puzzling to me.
What happened was that there was a motion to dismiss for failure to join indispensable parties. That was around the same time that my client was in the process of getting a new lawyer. I expected that the new lawyer would arrive immediately and contact me. I spoke with some, but I decided to try to assist the client. I knew who the parties were that should be joined. So to give him assistance and to allow the new lawyer to take the case over in a cleaner route, I made no changes to the complaint other than I added the two parties who the record title examination had indicated had a contingent mineral interest in the property. So I was just trying as attorney to fix things up a little bit and get the case back on track.
What do you do, or would you respond, I guess, to Ms. Hines' argument that you're now aware there's a statute of limitations defense, and you filed anyway? I mean, how do you respond to that? And the court apparently was very concerned about that.
Well, it's not an easy life we always face, and I was trying to get discussions with my client and have them do things like settle the case. He would not follow my guidance here. I was concerned about the statute of limitations, and I tried to deal with it in as professional a manner as I could by trying my client to recognize it and then withdrawing from the case. And yes, as a technical rule, my amendment of the complaint did restate that. But I wasn't making it any worse. I was trying to fix it up by at least getting the right parties in there.
You were aware of the statute of limitations issue, which appears to be very obvious.
The statute of limitations defense had been raised by then, and I was aware.
Well, then why would you refile the complaint if knowing that it couldn't survive?
She had made a motion. Opposing counsel had made a motion for failure to join indispensable parties. I knew who those parties were, and I at least got my client's permission to add the new parties.
I understand, but out of the case, have to enter the and have to refile the same complaint. If you were aware of the obvious issue there and looked like a winner, why would you not take that into account in refiling the complaint?
My client assured me that wasn't a good defense, that he said he would investigate the matter further, that as to the prior quiet title action that appeared to have been filed by his mother, that he believed that it had resolved itself in some manner, and told me that he was going to provide me with documents to support that.
Shouldn't you do that investigation before you file a complaint?
I don't, when I file complaints, I'm not really focusing on the affirmative defenses that may be submitted by the defendant.
We're aware of it. This time they raised it once, clearly going to raise it again. And you have a duty to investigate before you file. You can't just take your client's word for it without any investigation.
I did investigate. I looked at the deeds and I thought I had a good reformation case here, and I really wasn't aware of the statute of limitations problem at the start. That I became aware of it later when it's asserted as an affirmative defense. I tried to do the best I can in a professional manner, recognizing my duty to the client to get the case in a shape that it wouldn't be dismissed, and recognizing my duty to the court not to assert frivolous claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kim. Thank you, and Ms. Hines. I appreciate the arguments and the briefs of both counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.